saving money on everything you need at Menards. Your roof is the first line of defense against the elements, and it enhances the appearance of your home's exterior. Owens Corning shingles offer ultimate protection and impressive curb appeal. Choose from 26 colors of Owens Corning Duration shingles and transform your home today. Shop our selection of roofing products on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer and find plenty of great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. Hey, amigos. You know what's really easy to do and even easier to forget? Please help me out and hit that like button if you're listening on YouTube. And if you're listening somewhere else, what the hell? Pop in, give me a thumb. Say hello while you're at it. It helps me a ton with the algorithm. And besides, it's real nice to see you there. And now, on to the show. Hey, welcome back, my friend. If I might lift the curtain on our little friend-to-friend exchange this week, I'd like to wish you all a very happy Independence Day. And to all those who celebrate the supplemental holiday, Independence from Meat Day, I wish you a very sincere go fuck yourself. That's right, boy. Now get back on the grill. And save some for me this time, you scaly prick. Let's get this done, friend. Fireworks are fun and all, but not while I'm trying to record. Trust me. So, simplyscarypodcast.com. You can become a patron there and listen to thousands of scary stories, no ads or anything. The entire catalog dating back to 2012 for just $7.99 a month. Just click on the patron button and follow the instructions. And hey, if you still got money coming out of your ears after that, check out patreon.com/drewblood too. So our tale tonight comes courtesy of my good friend, your good friend, hell, everybody's good friend, good old Jeff. In it, we join Kevin, who finds himself entangled in the dark side of assisted living. So without further delay, from author Jeff Sturdivant, The Organization.
Uno.
I know how this sounds, but there's an unspoken rule in the grocery delivery business to avoid getting into conversations with the elderly while you're on the clock. Your perishables are likely to spoil before you make it to your next delivery. I happen to enjoy talking to my elderly customers, but it's true, they talk me to death. Speaking of death, my customers love to bring that up. The subject is a kind of novelty to them. It's their own little dirty joke they can spout with impunity. I say they deserve it. While we all try so hard to ignore the fact of our mortality, they've earned the right to remind us that we're all going to end up in the same place. See, my customers don't fear death. What they fear is that no one will listen to them anymore. So I listen. And God knows they talk me to death. Hyacinth, formerly of apartment 211, once told me she couldn't wait to die.
"Take me now,"
she said.
"I'm ready. Take me, and take these arthritis fingers."
Then her eyes darted around, sure she had chanted some deadly incantation. "Stop it," I said. "You're not going to die." Hyacinth died shortly afterward, but not that afternoon. That afternoon, I left her very much alive, with all her fruits and vegetables. She was a nice lady. So there I was again, bringing the old-timers their groceries. I parked the van in my usual spot in front of the building, close enough to load my cart on the sidewalk, but with enough space behind me for an ambulance to pull in. 500 tenants in their 70s, 80s, and beyond meant plenty of ambulance visits. I loaded up my cart and wheeled it in, the familiar warmth and smell of an old closet. Off the atrium, there's a common room where all the old folks gather to chat and listen to big band music on the record player. Often you'll hear laughter mixed in with the music. Thunder in old voices. Everyone talking over their hearing aids. I tried to sneak by on my way to the elevators, but if any of my regulars were in there, I was sure to get dragged in for a little small talk. Today, Charlie Vandergriff spotted me and waved me in to join the chat. I left my card in the hall and went on in. Gotta keep this short, I thought. No open-ended questions. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, son. How's life?
Is he your son?
Said Beatty Smith, apartment 127.
I didn't know you had a son.
He's not my son.
Because I didn't think you had a son.
He's the delivery man, Beatty.
She looked at me, squinting behind her glasses.
Oh, right. I thought you were his son. I was thinking to myself, I never knew the grocery man was Charlie's son.
Nope, I said. No relation.
The doctor says I have to have surgery.
Good heavens. Why didn't you tell me?
I did, Beatty. I got something in my neck. I can't swallow right.
That's awful, I said.
I have to melt my pills in water, and it tastes terrible.
Helen says I should take vitamins.
I never took them. It's enough trouble with the pills. They taste terrible.
That sounds awful, I said.
I had to put my steak in the food processor machine with gravy.
Helen says I should take vitamins, but I don't know. I've got blood sugar already. What if it does something?
Vitamins shouldn't affect your blood sugar.
Oh, I don't know.
I told the doctor. I said, why bother? I'm going to be dead soon anyway. Why cut me into pieces? I have to cut my food into pieces. Now me too? Hell.
You're not going to be dead soon. Stop it.
I don't mind. Let me die before anything else goes wrong.
Helen says I should take vitamins. What do you think?
I never took them.
I better get going, I said. Nice talking to you two. Take it easy, Charlie. Feel better.
Have a nice life, son.
Is he your son?
I had two deliveries. Agnes Brown, apartment 315, has no legs, so I helped her put her groceries in the cabinets and refrigerator. Then she insisted I wait while she rummaged through her purse to look for 4 quarters.
Buy yourself a cup of coffee, she said.
Henry Thompson, apartment 220, was too proud to ask for help, but he did make me listen to his usual war story again, with its latest revisions.
We're all hunkered down in the barracks, getting shelled to hell and back. Hell yeah, I was scared. Not too proud to admit it. Lucky the Krauts weren't wasting their good stuff on us, and no major damage. Then the squad leader says, let's get out there and let them know we're doing just fine. So I'm out there behind these sandbags with the grenade launcher at 2 a.m. I don't know if we got any of them, but we didn't lose anyone either. Lost some sleep, though. I'm still tired. I'll be dead soon anyway.
Oh, stop it, I said. Henry, like all the others, had no real money or family for support. This place was a godsend for the dispossessed elderly, a place to live for next to nothing. Modest as the accommodations were, tiny studio units, kitchenette, and bathroom, without such cheap housing, these folks could never afford the groceries I brought them every day. It was only that afternoon, pushing my empty cart back to the elevator, I got my first inkling that something was strange about Coliseum Retirement Home. I heard some stifled commotion and turned to see the door to room 209 was slightly ajar, Ms. Higgins' place. I thought about ignoring it. It could have been anything. Ms. Higgins might have been constipated for all I knew. But what if she needed help? I decided to take a look. I nudged the door and peeked inside.
Hello? Everything all right?
What I saw nearly stopped my heart. It was Darian and Sam, the facilities and maintenance guys. In between them writhed Agatha Higgins. They'd gagged her and bound her feet and hands with duct tape. Sam had her hooked under the arms and Darian was struggling with her kicking feet.
Jesus, what are you doing?
All three of them turned their heads my way. Ms. Higgins squealed unintelligibly behind the gag.
Hey, Kevin, said Darian.
Put her down.
You don't understand. Damn it, Sam. You leave the door open?
Whoops, Sam said.
What is there to understand? I said.
said Ms. Higgins. Sam shushed her.
Listen, Kevin, this ain't what it looked like, so keep your hat on. And please, keep your voice down.
Sam bit a length of duct tape off a roll and put it over Ms. Higgins' gag. She waved her head to avoid it, but the tape went on.
That's better. I told you to shush.
Do you really need to do that?
Of course, Darian said. You think we just tie up nice old ladies for no reason?
You know us, said Sam.
I did know them, at least casually, and I'd always thought they were good guys, but this didn't look so good.
This doesn't look so good, I said.
You're right. Out of context, this doesn't look good. I get it.
What context? Darian sighed. He and Sam glanced knowingly at each other.
So what? Are we supposed to tell them? Said Sam.
I don't think we have a choice, said Darian.
Tell me what?
Listen, Kevin, could you just please check and make sure no one's out in the hall?
I looked at Ms. Higgins, who seemed to be running out of steam. Then I looked at Darian. What should I do, yell for help? Call the police? But it was the expression on his face, more phlegmatic than anything, that stopped me. I found myself backing towards the doorway, looking out into the hall.
No one there, I said.
Good, let's go. Stay quiet, Kev. We'll discuss this in the office.
I walked alongside Sam and Darian with Ms. Higgins in tow. She'd given up struggling and just hung limp while they carried her.
Does she need medical care? I asked.
Maybe stubborn old Ms. Higgins needed a trip to the doctor and didn't want to go. Maybe that's all it is. The maintenance boys are good guys. They wouldn't do something like this without a good reason for it, would they?
Medical care? No. She's fit as a fiddle.
We stopped at the end of the hall by the trash chute.
Get that for me, Kevin.
What, the trash chute?
Yeah, grab the door there, would you?
So I pulled open the door. The sour odor of garbage wafted up from below. Before I could even consider what I was doing, they hoisted Ms. Higgins and tipped her head first into the chute. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. This must be a joke.
Don't worry, Darian said. We're not hurting her.
And they pushed her through the door until only her wiggling feet were visible. Muffled moans of exasperation echoed in the tin chamber. She was writhing like a nightgown larva. Sam gave the bottoms of her dirty slippers a final push, and with a squeak, she disappeared down the chute.
I know what you're thinking, Darian said.
I didn't even know what I was thinking. I couldn't even speak.
We didn't just throw Mrs. Higgins in the garbage. Anything over 100 pounds trips to the verter.
So what the hell just happened? Is Ms. Higgins all right?
We sat at a folding table in the first floor maintenance room, Sam and Darian's dim, greasy little hideaway. Darian offered me a cigarette and I took it. I didn't smoke often, but I needed something, and maybe a cigarette was it.
Okay, so here's the deal, Darian said.
You
understand the basic premise of this home, correct?
I should, I've been delivering groceries here for years. A publicly funded home for the forsaken elderly. Helpless men and women without money or family. 500 ultra-efficient units on 5 floors. A merciful social project. Sure, of course, I said.
All right. So how do you figure a place like this stays in operation? Electricity, water, taxes, insurance, salaries, etc.
And maintenance,
added Sam.
Donations and subsidies? Really? How much value in dollars do you think America places on our tenants here?
I never thought about it. Darian nodded. He lit my cigarette, then his. Sam was leaning against a filing cabinet eating potato chips.
Nice guys like you give people way too much credit.
The truth is, Darian said, the government, the public, people don't much revere their elderly.
They know what's right, Sam said, but it's a lot easier to turn their heads.
A lot cheaper, too,
added Darian.
I guess, I said.
Darian sat back and took a long drag from his cigarette. A cloud was gathering around the bare light bulb overhead.
Here's what they say when no one's listening. They live longer and longer. They eat up all the food. They run up the bills. They're a burden. That's how they justify themselves. But want to know the truth?
I nodded.
The truth is, they remind us of what we're all trying to ignore. Our mortality.
It's human nature. It's easier just to pretend they don't exist.
And cheaper.
I get it, I said. But I don't get it. Where are you going with this? Is she all right?
The money. Like I was saying, even a supposed non-profit organization like this one needs to make money. Nobody's doing this for free, and nobody's paying for it out of the kindness of their hearts.
And nobody's doing all the upkeep out of the kindness of their hearts either, Sam added.
I took a short drag on my cigarette and coughed. Darian grinned.
Not a smoker, are you?
Just a little wound up from before.
I can see that.
I took a little drag and managed not to cough.
I'm still not making the connection here.
We think you ought to see it for yourself,
Darian said.
Tomorrow night. Be here at 10 p.m. and we'll fill in the blanks.
I paused. What's happening tomorrow? Is Miss Higgins okay?
You'll see it for yourself, and you'll have an unforgettable night.
Dressed to impress, Sam added.
Right. Look sharp. A tux if you can.
A tux? I took a deep breath and looked at my watch. My half-hour break time was almost up.
I don't know about this, I said. Is Ms. Higgins all right?
Darian rolled his eyes.
Listen, I know you must be tentative after what you saw, but you weren't supposed to see it. You need to get the whole picture. I can't just have you walk out of here thinking we're criminals. You understand that, don't you?
There was a tension in the room while I wondered what to say. I don't know if I want to be involved.
You already are involved, said Sam sharply.
I looked at him.
That's what Darian is trying to tell you. You became involved when you helped us stick Mrs. Higgins in the chute.
What? I didn't help? I didn't even know what the hell you were doing. I still don't. How do I know nobody's going to stick me down a trash chute?
Kevin, if we wanted to stick you in the trash chute, don't you think we had the opportunity?
Sam nodded. In a minute, I nodded too. He was right. They were right.
Plus, Sam said, we're putting our asses on the line here. We're only inviting you because we have to.
He's right. People pay crazy money to see this. This is big.
Seriously?
No kidding. Be here. Trust me.
God knows I had nothing to do tomorrow, let alone anything worth crazy money to anyone. The life of a grocery boy, and my life was on the boring end of that spectrum.
Plus, it was the only way to put my mind at ease about Ms. Higgins.
Come on, Darian said. Tell me you'll be here.
He winked at me the way he does.
All right, I said. I'll be here.
Darian nodded.
And Kevin?
Yeah?
Keep it under your hat. God help you. Not a word.
Dos.
I couldn't focus on work for the rest of the day, and getting to sleep that night proved impossible. Around midnight, I got out of bed and went to look for that tux I knew I had somewhere. I ended up finding it at the bottom of an old bag of clothes in my closet. I found my iron and unwrapped the old cord and set the iron in on the rug. Life is strange. Alone at night in the perfect quiet of my dirty little apartment, there's nothing to distract you from the strangeness. I've always delivered food. Before starting in the grocery store, I delivered pizza. I was in school at the time, working leisurely towards a liberal arts degree, whatever that is. One sunny day, I arrived at my delivery and got out of the car and just stood there for a minute with the sun on the back of my neck. And the realization just poured right into me. I realized that delivering food was all I really wanted to do. I had no idea what I was doing school-wise. All I knew was I liked my day job. That was almost 15 years ago, and every dollar I've made since has been from delivering food. Some nights I would sit there, alone and single, wondering what things would have been like if I'd stayed in college. It's funny how your sensibilities change over the years. A pleasant ray of sunshine on the neck of a 19-year-old offers no warmth on the cold nights of your mid-30s. 19 is a lousy age for a guy to have a revelation. By sunrise, I realized I was in no shape to go to work, and I called in sick with my best scratchy voice. After getting a few hours sleep, I made coffee and went outside to grab the paper. Old Mrs. Henderson was out walking her little designer dog. I can't remember the kind of dog, only that it was absurdly expensive. Her husband had left her more money than she could possibly spend anyway. She waved hello, and I stood and waited while she walked over.
No work today, Kevin?
I couldn't sleep last night.
That's a shame. I hope you feel better.
I'm all right, just tired.
The little dog was sniffing at my leg. I reached down to pet it.
How old are you now, Kevin?
35.
When are you going to settle down? I'll bet you have all sorts of girlfriends.
Not a one.
That surprises me. They say being married helps you sleep better, you know.
Interesting.
You might sleep better, that's all.
10 p.m., Friday, January 16th.
As I drove up to the building that night, my heart thudding in my chest the whole way, a helicopter was descending to the roof, scattering old shards of leaves and debris over the entranceway. I pulled off into the visitor area. This time I had no business in the loading zone. Must be a medical emergency. Hope it's not one of my regulars. I got out of the car and watched it come down, my suit jacket billowing in the breeze. It didn't look like a medical helicopter. It was jet black. I thumbed Darian's extension into the intercom, and after a few rings, he answered.
Kevin?
Yeah, it's me.
Good. Come on in.
Good. Come on in.
It was strange in the building that night. Dead quiet. The exit signs lit bright red, the moonlight in the windows at the end of the wings.
I was there nearly every day, but tonight I felt like an intruder. What the hell are you doing, Kevin? Turn around and get out of here now. Call the police, you dummy. You witnessed an assault. I stopped for a moment in the middle of the hall, listening to the voice of reason in my head. I had witnessed an assault. Normally, I'd have called the police right away. So why didn't I? Because I was scared?
because I was confused or because I was curious. I stood there feeling the hammering of my heart, the blood rushing in my ears. I couldn't remember the last time my heart beat like that. I couldn't remember the last time I felt anything at all, not since that warm sunbeam landed on the back of my neck and I decided to accept my destiny. I was curious, irresistibly curious. I knocked on the maintenance door and Darian answered right away. Sam was there too, sitting and smoking. They were both looking spiffy in their tuxedos. I had to grin.
Howdy, Darian said. Ready for a big night?
I don't know what to be ready for.
You heard the chopper? Sam asked.
I saw it land up there. Is there an emergency?
If I told you who was in it, you'd never believe me.
Well, who is it?
You'll see. Don't worry.
He checked his watch. Ms. Higgins all right?
She's fine, Darian said.
Fighting shape, Sam said.
All right, we ready?
Sam stood up.
Let's go.
We started towards the door.
But Kevin,
Darian said. He held up a finger.
I'm fairly sure it goes without saying, but I have to make it clear. What you saw the other day, what you're going to see tonight, you never tell a soul, anyone, ever. Are we in agreement?
Yes, I said. At this point, it was implied. A day and a half after the incident took place, I was just as guilty as they were for staying quiet as long as I did. But more important than that, I felt something even more powerful than guilt. Excitement. In the elevator, Darian pushed the buttons for floors 1 and 5 simultaneously. After holding them a few seconds, the lights dimmed and the elevator began to descend.
We're going down? I asked.
We'd been on the first floor to begin with. He nodded. Not only did we go down, but we seemed to go down forever. At some point, I thought I felt us stop, move sideways, and descend again. When we finally did stop, the door opened to a rush of earthy air. We stepped out into some dim concrete tunnel.
What in the world?
Follow me,
said Darian, his voice amplified in the throaty corridor. Unseen drips thunked into unseen puddles. As we walked, I sensed rhythmic vibrations resonating through the walls. Ominous at first. Then I realized what it was. Music. Dance music. At the hall's end was a slab steel door, and Darian stopped me short.
Almost forgot,
he said, and reached into his pocket and pulled out a gold coin the size of a silver dollar. He handed it to me. Embossed on the face was a strange symbol, some kind of intricate sphere.
If anyone stops you, if anyone asks who you are, just show them the token. Think of it as your ticket stub.
I put the coin in my pocket. Sam approached the console, and 7 beeps later, a pneumatic hiss, metallic clank, and the door slid open. They both turned to watch my reaction as I looked inside. Bright spotlights twisted through the dark room, moving in time with the loud music. I stepped forward and looked around. An enormous underground chamber, full of people, full of lights. There was clearly a party going on, one of unprecedented size. Darian smiled at me. My eyes must have been the size of dinner plates.
Come on,
Darian said, and they led me down a winding esplanade, dozens and dozens of well-dressed debutantes, laughing and chatting with their drinks. I couldn't tell whether the thumping in my chest was my heart or the pounding bass. We made our way towards what appeared to be the centerpiece of it all, a walled circular pit 5 feet high at the rim, maybe 50 feet deep. At the opening of a wide staircase, you could see down galleries of steep stadium seating funneling around the pit. An amphitheater, all stone and marble. The floor was rimmed with spikes like giant punji sticks, wound and strung with chains. Dimly illuminating the pit were red floodlights, panning the sandy floor. Some unseen crowd of partiers cheered in unison from a writhing galaxy of lights.
Holy shit! Welcome to the Colosseum!
I managed to pull my gaze from the pit and look around at the surrounding pavilions. As my eyes adjusted, the dark revealed scores and scores of sharply dressed patrons, drinking, talking, dancing. Tiki-style bars, blue neon shining brightly in their bar mirrors. Two topless hula girls swinging around poles made to look like palm trees. A sprawling dance floor encircled the chamber, undulating with dancers. An elevated DJ booth with its little silhouette bouncing back and forth in the flashing lights.
It's amazing, I said.
Darian and Sam were smiling. Darian leaned close to me so I could hear him.
How about some dinner?
I don't get paid for another week.
Not necessary, Sam said. It's all included.
The far end of the chamber was much quieter. There were two restaurants, one French, one Japanese, and we all agreed on sushi. A white-faced geisha waitress took our orders and promptly returned with hot sake and a huge platter of magnificent-looking food.
You sure this is free?
Are you kidding? Do you think we could afford this?
So? What do you think?
Sam said. He tipped back a cup of sake.
I have no words, I said. I really didn't.
I'm sure you'll come up with a few,
Darian said, pouring a shot into my cup.
Hey, want to know who that was in the chopper?
Sure.
He nodded behind me, and I turned to look. It was difficult to see in the dimness, but my eyes adjusted, and there they were.
Are you kidding me?
Holding court at a private table on one of the terrace platforms were former presidents Bill Clinton and George Bush. Several tuxedoed men sat with them, and more at nearby tables seemed to be watching in protection.
They're here for the show.
And there,
Darian said, pointing at a distant table. Squinting, I made out the unmistakable profile of Daniel Stern. He was sitting with John Hurd.
Get out.
Those two haven't missed a show since Chud.
You're sitting in probably the most exclusive place in the country right now, Sam said. The rich, the famous, and us.
Not a bad perk, huh?
Darian said.
Guaranteed we're the only janitors in here right now.
Facilities and maintenance technicians, said Sam.
His eyes were starry in the light of the candles. The sake had obviously done its trick. Darian laughed.
He's one proud janitor.
I get it, I said. I'm a delivery engineer. Boy, that's a stretch.
I'll give you that. This is really something, guys. I haven't been out in a long, long time.
You gotta let loose sometime. Life is short. Can't spend the whole thing working.
I'm thinking you're right. With the alcohol warming my stomach and everything else overwhelming my senses, I hadn't even thought of Ms. Higgins. But that wouldn't last long. It was midnight when a voice came booming over the PA system.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome again to the Colosseum!
Applause erupted through the circle of the chamber. I followed everyone's gaze to a high buttress overlooking the far side of the room. The way it was designed, it appeared to be floating in midair. On it stood a regally robed figure holding something like a scepter.
It's the Archon,
Darian said.
In the tradition of the organization, we select before each event the next of the 12. Allow me now to direct your attention to the sphere of judgment!
More applause, and from high above, a huge and dark shape was descending to hang above the pit. As it came into the light, it seemed to blanket the chamber with a reverent hush. Some kind of rust-tortured gyroscope. Through the metallic ribs, you could see a shining core engraved with numbers. I noticed it was the same sphere pictured on the gold token Darian had given me. With a sound like creaking gears, the core began to move and gradually picked up to a spin. The Archon then continued.
Yes, the world spins small and silent under the apathetic stars. Mankind waits fearfully in the imminence of death. But we, the organization, understand there can be no light without darkness. No life without death. So with death, we celebrate life.
For the organization, the crowd chanted. What's this about? I asked Darian. He leaned in close.
12 new combatants over the course of a year. Before every show, the Sphere of Judgment picks the next electee.
Wait, so Miss Higgins was...
Last month's electee to be tonight's combatant.
Combatant? What is she going to do, play bingo? The core of the Sphere of Judgment was spinning fast, the numbers flying by too quick to read. The Archon raised his scepter and brought it down with a sound like a judge's gavel. The core began to wind down, and eventually the numbers became legible.
So each month, Darian said, it's a 1 in 500 chance to get selected.
I was watching the numbers flick by as the core lost its momentum. It was almost hypnotic, too. The Archon continued.
Tonight, midnight of the third Friday of the first month of the year, we have for you Agatha M. Higgins, number 209, 78 years of age, and our champion, Helen R. Shoemaker, number 445, 74 years of age. As always, the prize for victory is... To live to fight another day!
The crowd chanted the same. I saw Daniel Stern and John Hurd high-five over at their table. The numbers were moving slower now. Slower. Slower. Then they stopped. In the rusty window showed number 284.
Apartment 284, I said. That's Charlie.
I didn't know if I was supposed to be happy for him or what. He never had any luck at bingo, I knew that much.
Charlie's it, Darian said. Next month, he fights tonight's winner.
What do you mean, fight?
Fight, said Sam. What else would it mean?
Well, what does it mean? A debate? A cook-off?
Number 284, said the Archon. Charles Vandegrift, 79 years of age.
The audience applauded. President Clinton had that pleased smile of his, clapping and nodding approvingly. President Bush patted him on the thigh and whispered something in his ear. I recalled Ms. Higgins then, the way Sam and Darian had carried her out of her apartment. I couldn't picture Charlie like that. Were they planning to stuff him down the trash chute too?
Are you guys going to do that thing to Charlie?
They looked at each other.
Not if we don't have to.
Ms. Higgins is a feisty one. She never leaves her apartment. Didn't want to yesterday either. The feisty ones take the chute. The agreeable ones, we can usually get them in the elevator quietly enough.
After the three of us finished dinner, we went to our seats. Simple stools next to the stadium's maintenance entrance with a clear view of the pit. I suppose we were going to see some kind of competition. Maybe some kind of performance art.
Either that, or there was some metaphor here I just wasn't getting. People filed from the bars down the stairs into the amphitheater. Everyone leased their own seats, Darian had told me. They cost more the closer you got to the bottom, but even the nosebleeds were obscenely expensive. Bush's and Clinton's, which were near ground level, were $200,000 apiece. To get in at all, you needed to know somebody. Then you had to crank open your wallet. Darian reiterated he and Sam had the best deal in the house and reminded me how lucky I was to be there with them. The crowd grew steadily quieter and the air grew stiff with tension. Just as I checked my watch to see it was 12:30 a.m., red floodlights filled the pit. Smoke machines poured a creeping mist out onto the sand. Up on his flying buttress of sorts, the Archon sat on a throne. He lifted his scepter and brought it down with a loud crack.
Ladies and gentlemen, the time has come. Allow me to introduce your competitors for this evening. First, our challenger!
Dylan elbowed me and gestured to a gate on the left side of the pit. The gate's vertical bars were sinking into the floor. When they disappeared entirely, sand rushing in to seal the holes, out she hobbled. I recognized her immediately for her darkly dyed bouffant, now opaque and purple in the bright floodlights. She wore the same floral dress she had on when Darian and Sam pushed her down the trash chute. Old Ms. Higgins looked in fine spirits. Only one thing peculiar about her. Her arms were fitted to the elbows with what appeared to be enormous chainsaws.
Get the hell out of here, I said.
My heart rate doubled in an instant. The audience was applauding and whistling and leaping out of their seats. Chants began. Chainsaw, chainsaw, chainsaw. Even Darian and Sam were up and chanting. And just when I thought things couldn't get any crazier, Ms. Higgins thrust her chainsaw arms up in the air and they went off like jet engines. Little streams of oily smoke joined in the midst of the fog machines. The chants gave way to lunatic applause. I stared at Ms. Higgins' face but saw no apprehension, no fear, not even a hint of distraction from all the ruckus. Nice old Ms. Higgins, who always ordered Pop-Tarts when her grandkids were coming to visit. And what I saw in her eyes now was something like determination.
How is she lifting those things? I asked Darian. She can't even put away her Pop-Tarts.
Weighing in at 157 pounds, 78 years old, one-time widow. She enjoys cooking and knitting afghans, but tonight, she's trying her hand, both hands in fact, at butchery, fighting to the death, Ms. Agatha Higgins!
The stadium blew over with a hollow rumble. I was still trying to grasp what I was seeing. She didn't even seem to be holding on to the chainsaws. Her arms were just kind of made into them. The skin was badly bruised where they wedged into the gauntlets that held them on. Don't they know she's on blood thinners?
And introducing our champion, 74 years young and one hot cookie. Widow of three, murderer of two. But this hot mama don't make shoes. She collects oven mitts and enjoys ballroom dancing. And boy, oh boy, this gal really cooks on the dance floor. Defending her title as two-time Bloodbath Coliseum champion. Helen Barbecue Shoemaker!
The crowd erupted once again. A gate lowered opposite Ms. Higgins and out she stepped, Mrs. Shoemaker, a pilot light glowing at one end of an armored arm.
hoses ran to a tank mounted on her back. She lifted her arms and let loose two gouts of fire. The stench of gas rolled over the stands on rippling waves of heat.
Jesus, I said. I thought she died.
I'm taking the champ,
Darian said.
She's a 3-1 favorite,
Sam said.
But you never know. Shoemaker's got the range, but if Higgins gets in there, all it takes is one good swing. Those saws are a son of a bitch.
So, without further delay, for the organization!
The crowd chanted for the organization. I looked around, the crowd in their fancy dress and unbridled excitement, the smoke rising off the floor of the pit below, the electric charge in the air of the arena. My mouth felt dry, and I realized it was hanging open. They aren't really going to
fight!
The Archon swung his scepter, and a gong sounded throughout the chamber. Suddenly, Ms. Higgins charged, one chainsaw leveled, one cocked back behind her head. I'd never seen her move beyond a geriatric shuffle, and now she bounded through the sand like a cheetah. Then she swung, hard, a whirring haymaker. Mrs. Shoemaker barely ducked in time. She rolled over in the sand, tank and all. I happened to know Mrs. Shoemaker's hips were ravaged by osteoporosis and arthritis. One day, she ordered double-sided tape with her groceries, and when I showed up, she talked me into securing the safety seat to the floor around her toilet. For half an hour, I heard all about her numerous health issues while I taped the aluminum rack to the tiles. I was sad when I heard she had died, but hardly surprised. Now I was surprised. Impossibly, she sprung up behind Ms. Higgins on what must have been a brand new pair of legs. Ms. Higgins was still recovering from the momentum of her big swing, and Mrs. Shoemaker clobbered her over the right ear with her big bionic arm. Ms. Higgins spun twice and went down. Shoemaker aimed both flamethrowers and bathed the sand in fire. The crowd winced at the sudden burst of bright flame, but when they receded, Higgins had gotten out of the way. She was back up and poised to swing. Shoemaker ducked, barely dodging another haymaker. She stumbled away, trying to open up enough space to counterattack, but Higgins was all over her. Shoemaker swung wildly, the flamethrower trailing a loop of blue flame. Higgins avoided getting clubbed, but winced with a face full of fire. She'd been burned. The crowd roared.
Ooh, clipped her,
said Darian. But Ms. Higgins didn't seem to mind being scorched and continued her charge, aiming a buzzing saw at Ms. Shoemaker's midsection. Shoemaker parried, but a loud metallic clank sent them both rebounding, and there was a split second of confusion as they regained their bearings. I realized I was digging my fingernails into my thighs. The crowd gasped. The blunder had opened up a fair amount of space, and Mrs. Shoemaker aimed both arms at her target. Darian elbowed me excitedly. It looked like this was it. For the first time, Ms. Higgins raised her saws in defense.
Here it is, here it is!
Shoemaker fired. Dwindling squirts of burning gas dribbled onto the sand. The crowd gasped again. Quickly, everyone understood what had happened. The tank. Ms. Higgins had clipped the tank. The pressure was gone. Mrs. Shoemaker was dumbstruck. Ms. Higgins wasted no time. She closed the distance and struck. Shoemaker raised an arm, which was promptly bisected at the elbow. It seemed to wait a moment before bleeding, then sprayed blood in gouts. The audience was out of their seats. Ms. Higgins continued her assault, severing the other arm at the shoulder, then her left leg mid-shin, tipping her into the sand. More shocking still was Mrs. Shoemaker's face. She was disappointed, not horrified, not even resigned. She looked like she had just burned a roast with a dinner guest waiting at the table. Ms. Higgins conversely glowed like she had just solved the puzzle on Wheel of Fortune. The light shined brightly on Mrs. Shoemaker's paling skin. Flowing blood gleamed bright, then soaked dully into the sand. Mrs. Help Me Young Man, Agatha Higgins, wearing a good-natured grin on her charred face, was carving up Mrs. Shoemaker like a turkey. Finally, she raised an arm high, then brought it down through her opponent and into the sand, where the saw ground to a halt. There was so little blood left in Mrs. Shoemaker, her head rolled off with barely a drip. I don't normally drink much, but tonight I needed it. After watching the Archon crown Mrs. Higgins the new champion and teasing her upcoming match against Charlie Vandergrift, everyone made their way back to the terraces and pavilions. The DJs turned on the music and the dancers resumed dancing. Bartenders poured drinks, waitresses weaved between tables. At the center of it all, the contents of Mrs. Shoemaker left a brown splotch on the arena floor. I was quiet as we returned to our table. It wasn't only that I didn't know what to say. It was that I seemed to be the only one horrified by all of this. I was scared that I'd be found out. They'd realize I didn't belong here. Then what would happen? Daniel Stern was gesticulating crazily over at the bar. John Hurd was clearly amused.
"So what'd you think?"
Darian said.
"Man, I'm jazzed right now."
"Great fight," said Sam.
No words came to me. I had to say something about it. I just didn't know what. Darian examined my face and tipped back a shot of Jägermeister.
"It's fucked, right?"
I looked at him.
"You can say what you're thinking. You don't have to hide it."
He gestured around the arena.
"Everyone here is aware that the ethics are questionable."
"Questionable?"
"Listen, I know how it looks. We all saw this too for the first time once. But there's more to this than you think."
George Bush was unfolding a wad of bills and counting them out to Bill Clinton. I guess he bet on Mrs. Shoemaker.
"There's no public funding, Kev. Donations don't pay for this building. The organization does."
The waitress came by, and we ordered another round of drinks. I asked for a double, then changed it to a triple.
"How long has this been going on, Darian?" "At this building here? Since the beginning. But the organization itself?"
He tapped his fingers on the table and looked at Sam.
"Since Caesar," Sam said.
"Trash."
I've been at the grocery store for 9 years now. Delivering the home shopping stuff is where I'm the most comfortable. I like it out on the road. Behind the shelves of the store is all the darkness of the food business. We have our own in-house butcher, and I've watched him cut pigs into all their more commonly known parts. By the time the pigs arrive, they've been mercifully removed of all character. Headless, footless, tailless, bloodless. Bleached, empty bodies. Without an imagination, you can hack them apart with comfortable apathy. Lenny the butcher has no imagination.
"It's all product to me."
My imagination has never been much help to me. I can't even make peace with fruits and vegetables. There's something offensive about the mileage of a salad. Lettuce from Mexico, cabbage from Guatemala, celery from Uzbekistan. Eating a salad feels to me like an unreasonable demand for attention. Processed meat is worse still. I have no problem eating the less favorable parts of an animal. It has a kind of Native American gratitude to it. Let no part of the animal go to waste. The perversion of a hot dog, however, is in the collective deaths to create it. One bite could fathomably contain the flesh of 1,000 creatures. We seem to know a hot dog is ugly. At least subconsciously we do. We hide it in a bun and pile it over with condiments and eat it without looking. We're watching sports. It isn't just the food that doesn't sit right with me. It's the whole waxy yellowed environment of the grocery store. Even the instrumental renditions popping from the ceiling sound waxy and yellowed. When I was a kid, I remember wondering what an anti-gravity walk up there might be like. To me, it looks like a bomb-blown city landscape painted white. And no one but the shoppers are happy to be here. Least happy of all may be the soda merchandisers. They cart up loads and loads of soda and drag it into the soda aisle to fill the shelves. I notice a lot of them have their wrists wrapped. They leave to stock another store for a few hours, then come back to the first, where the shelves have already been emptied, and stock them all over again. There's a built-in futility to it that eliminates all gratification beyond pay. The fourth level of Dante's Hell, where the greedy push their boulders up the hills only to have them roll back down. This is the life of the soda merchandiser. I once saw a Coke guy pushing one cart in front of him while pulling another behind him, a technique they call walk like an Egyptian. The Egyptians knew how to move some heavy stuff, but the pictures are a poor demonstration of actual ergonomics. You could hear the disc snap in his spine before he spilled out onto the linoleum. Since then, I've been extra careful with my back. Recently, I asked a Pepsi merchandiser what the hardest part of the job was. I imagined he would bring up the hot trailers, the heavy bottles, maybe even the unrelenting elevator music, but he had more time to consider my question than I thought.
"The pointlessness of life," he said.
I can relate to that. The life of a working schlub can be boring. But after seeing the trouble a little excitement can get you into, the whole point seems a little different. 3 weeks had gone by since the organization thing. One more week until the next ceremony. I'd run into Darian 5 or 6 times, who kept asking me if I was coming again.
"Don't underestimate Miss Higgins," he told me. "Sure, Charlie's got her in the size department, but listen, she's down there right now getting the champions treatment. Might be new weapons, might be who knows what. Charlie's up here scratching his balls, no idea what's going on."
I told him I'd be there. I tried to feign enthusiasm. I was afraid that if I didn't, he'd begin to distrust me. Who knows what he'd do if he thought I was a rat. I'd already seen him tie up an old lady and stuff her down a garbage hole. He wasn't averse to seeing people die either, so what would stop him from killing me? Come Friday, I'd tell him I was sick. Maybe I'd even tell him to bet a couple bucks on Charlie for me, just to throw him off, the coward I am. And Charlie? Poor Charlie. I saw Charlie in the common room at least several times a week. I couldn't help being morose when we chatted, and it wasn't lost on him.
"You sure you're all right, son? Look a little pale. When was the last time you took yourself on vacation?"
"You should take vitamins," said Beatty,
apartment 127.
"Do you take vitamins?"
"I'm all right," I told them both.
"I told the doctor I've been putting steak in the blender, so he tells me. Charlie, you ever try Salisbury steak?" I said no, so he tells me to give it a try. And you know what? It isn't so bad, and it goes down pretty easy."
"Helen said not to eat those Salisbury steaks. They're full of salt."
"So's the ocean, and the fish are fine, aren't they?"
"I never thought of that."
I can't explain why, but Charlie's comment about the Salisbury steak struck a nerve in me. Maybe because it was some rare good news. He had found something he liked, something he enjoyed. Even if that was all the good news he had ever had, even if a salty, hungry man TV dinner was the only thing he lived for, it still meant he had something to live for. But that wasn't all he lived for. He did things. He liked coming down to the common room, chatting with the other residents, listening to the record player. He liked to say hi to me when I showed up with a delivery, and I was just going to let this happen to him? I couldn't.
Charlie, listen. We have to talk. Somewhere private.
Charlie had never heard my tone of voice this way.
What is it, son?
Can we just go somewhere else a minute?
Well, sure, I suppose. Let me just get up.
I helped him up, and we walked down the hall to the laundry room. Luckily, no one was in there.
Are you all right, son?
Yeah, I'm fine. It's nothing like that. I have to get you out of here.
What? How do you mean?
I checked around to make doubly sure no one was around. He watched me concernedly.
Charlie, you're not safe here. You have to leave.
What? Son, I don't get it.
I can't explain it to you right now, at least not here. You've just got to trust me. Just trust me.
Charlie's face was somewhere between confused and concerned.
You know me, I said. I'll explain it to you later. Just grab what you need and I'll get you whatever else you need. But I have to get you out of here. Today.
I admit it took some effort to maintain my resolve for the rest of the day. I'd start to lose my nerve, then remind myself how I felt back in the common room. I have to do what little I can. I can't go up against the Archon. I can't go up against Bush and Clinton and the cast of Chud. And who knows who else. I can't even defend myself against Darian and Sam if it comes down to it. I'll end up at the bottom of a trash bin. I just want to save Charlie. One thing at a time. Save Charlie. Charlie packed a bag of essentials and met me out by the loading area at 6 p.m. where I sat with my lights off. I helped him into my car and we left around the back of the building.
Did anyone see you leave? I said.
Everybody's in the game room that would have seen me. It's card night.
Good.
My heart was pounding. Relax, I told myself. You made it.
So, you're gonna tell me what the problem is or what?
Charlie had shaved and put on aftershave. I felt guilty for rushing him out of his home, even though I knew I was saving his life. A guy Charlie's age shouldn't have to be dragged around like this.
You're not going to believe me. I can barely believe it. I saw it, and I still can't believe it.
Well, come out with it, son. I can barely believe I just let the delivery man kidnap me.
I glanced over at him. Remember Helen? Shoemaker?
Sure. Poor gal passed away a few months back. We had coffee a time or two.
She didn't die 3 months ago when she disappeared. She died 1 month ago.
Charlie paused a moment.
How do you mean? They had the funeral.
She was killed. Last month.
Charlie was silent for a minute. I felt his gaze on me as I drove. I wished he had just stopped right there with the questions. I wish he'd just trust me.
Son, how do you know that?
Remember Nettie, apartment 424? They killed her too.
Who do you mean they? Who killed them?
The organization they call themselves. They force people to kill each other under the building. They kill 12 people a year. And you were supposed to be next.
That's crazy talk.
I know how it sounds, Charlie, but it's true. I saw Mrs. Shoemaker die. She didn't die 3 months ago when she disappeared. She died 1 month ago, under the building. She'd been fighting down there for months.
Charlie was quiet again.
Say it's true what you're saying. What happened?
So I told him the whole story, and finished just as we pulled up around the back of my place and parked the car. I turned off the car and looked at him, waited for his reaction.
Son, I'm not good at many things, but I can smell bullshit for miles. Always could. Still can.
You don't believe me?
I'm not saying that, because I at least know you believe it. And I'd be lying if I said you didn't scare me. Because you did, for one reason or another.
I'm not letting it happen. Not to you.
Thank you, son. But what now?
I don't know. We'll figure it out. The old man sitting in my living room chair wasn't the same Charlie I'd knew from the retirement home. He didn't say much. He mostly just sat and watched TV. I made him a frozen Salisbury steak dinner and sat with him while he ate. It took him a long time to eat it. How did they expect this old man to get into that pit and fight for his life? Then again, Ms. Higgins could barely lift the grocery bag, and she wielded those chainsaws like some kind of murderous lumberjack. Was it possible? It was all just so bizarre.
Kevin!
Charlie was wiping his mouth with a napkin.
Yeah? What am I supposed to do?
I don't know. We'll figure something out.
You really sure about all this gobbledygook you were telling me?
If I wasn't, I would have never dragged you out of your home like that.
So when can I go back?
You don't want to go back, Charlie. I saw what they wanted to do to you.
Because I have nowhere else to go.
I know it. I know. I just have to figure it out, that's all. He paused for a moment.
But what if you're wrong about all this?
I know what I saw. We didn't speak for a while. I looked online for other fully subsidized homes for the elderly, but there were none anywhere. Even if there had been, I remembered what Darian told me. There aren't enough donations to keep a place like that running. And if I did find another free rest home, what if it had its own organization? Maybe the same organization. Inevitably, the grim truth became clear. Charlie truly had nowhere else to go. When I came home from work Wednesday, Charlie was sitting in front of the TV. My apartment had begun to smell like his favorite aftershave lotion. 2 days until the next organization ceremony. In 48 hours, Charlie was scheduled to fight to the death, and here he was watching Jeopardy in my apartment. "Heya, Charlie," I said. "I got you more TV dinners." He turned to me with sallow eyes shining in the light of the TV set.
"Son, I know you mean well and all, but I've had some time to think, and, well, I think I'm going to go ahead and go back home."
I wasn't surprised to hear him say it. None of us had come up with any plans. I had several deliveries to the building in the past few days, and people had noticed he was gone, including Sam and Darian. Darian was vacuuming the hall when I ran into him the day before. He seemed distraught, and I knew why.
"Guess who's missing?"
he said. "Who?" He checked to be sure no one was around.
"This month's combatant."
"Charlie? Where'd he go?" I wanted to swallow, but willed my throat still.
"I was hoping you'd know. If I don't have him by Thursday, I don't know what's going to happen. You sure you have no idea at all? Sam's losing his mind over it."
"I haven't seen or heard from him." Darian sighed and shook his head.
"Christ, they're going to kill me if I don't deliver him on time."
"They'll kill you?"
"Look, I got this general rule I like to follow. And that rule is, don't piss off Archon Bloodbath."
"Can't they just pick someone else?"
"Stats are up. Bets are placed. and this has never happened before. The Archon's not going to like it.
He looked in my eyes.
You sure you have no idea? You know him pretty well, don't you?
I wouldn't say that. I chat with him here and there.
Let me know if you hear anything, okay? It takes 24 hours to get done whatever they do to these old folks. If I don't produce Charlie by Thursday, I don't know what they're going to do about it. And I don't know what's going to happen to me and Sam either.
It was hard not to feel sorry for Darian at the time, evil as the whole thing was. But now it looked like he might get his man after all. If Charlie believed a word of what I'd told him, he'd never want to go back. He must think I've lost my mind, but I can't just let him do this to himself. It's suicide. If I let him go back, it's practically homicide by negligence.
Charlie, listen. If you go back, they're going to get you. Plus, you have to understand the situation you're putting me in right now.
I know what you think, son.
Do you think I'm crazy?
I think you're a fine man. But I don't have the energy for this. Not to mention, I don't have a whole lot of time left anyhow. And I appreciate everything. I gotta get on.
I can't force you to stay, but you're asking me to...
Son, I'll be fine. I just called the maintenance boys. One of them set to pick me up in an hour.
My stomach went sour. I don't know what my face looked like just then, but Charlie sure picked up on it.
Hey, don't worry,
Charlie said.
I didn't tell them about any of the gobbledygook you told me. I only told them you offered to put me up a while.
Charlie, no more messing around. We have to get the hell out of here. Right now.
What do you mean? I told you I'm going home.
Is that your final choice? Because we don't have the time right now to argue about this.
I'm sorry, son. I've been thinking a lot about it, and well, I really think you need that vacation.
It was no use. I told Charlie to lock the door on his way out, and that I was going to stay with my brother in Bethesda. I have no brother in Bethesda, no surviving family at all. So when they dragged that information out of Charlie, maybe they'd go looking for me in the wrong places. It started raining just as I left. Running down the back alley behind the house, leaving my apartment and my car and all my belongings behind, it struck me the same way it had when I'd gotten out of the car with that fateful pizza delivery the day I decided on my destiny. I had no control over my destiny. I had no control over what happened to me. I had no control over what happened to other people. I had no control over anything at all. Ducking from headlights, I found my way through backyards, alleys, and dimly lit arteries to the old motor lodge by the highway. The yard was full of tractor trailers, and I weaved my way through the dark to the office. It was 9 p.m., and I knew they had Charlie by now. I assumed they already knew I had told him everything, and by now, he knew I'd told him the truth after all. He must be scared to death. The room was small and dusty and smelled like stale cigarette smoke, but at least it was dry. I sat on the edge of the bed just thinking. What was next? Where would I go? Did I have to change my name? How the hell did I get into this giant mess? I never asked for any of this. I never meant to happen upon a kidnapping. I never asked to be invited to some geriatric death match. All I wanted to do was deliver groceries, and when the situation called for it, to save one old man. Was that too much to ask? Had I completely derailed the wheel of fortune? Or was this my destiny after all? When the adrenaline finally subsided, I was so drained, so exhausted, I lay down and passed out in my wet clothes. I don't remember falling asleep.
Cuatro.
Knots are cruel sometimes. When I started delivering pizza, I had this recurring nightmare where I'd have a ton of deliveries in my car and get completely lost for hours and hours. It happened from time to time where you'd be a little late, and even that stressed me out immensely, but nothing like these nightmares of mine. In the dreams, I'd be passing signs that said, "Last exit before Tennessee," and "Welcome to Pennsylvania." It was always a relief to wake up from dreams like that. I had no dreams that night, but waking up was no relief either. I woke to cold and damp. I reached to pull up the covers, but my arm refused to move. Must have slept on it wrong. But no, I tried turning over and found I couldn't move at all. I was completely immobilized, tied down. I panicked. Struggled with all my strength. I fought against the leathery bindings, twisting my wrists, wringing the flesh of my arms, but it was no use. Eventually, I gave up and just lay there with my chest heaving. I wanted to believe it was a dream, but the earthy, dank smell proved to me what I didn't want to believe. I remembered it from the moment those elevator doors opened up. They'd found me. I was underground. It wasn't long before I heard approaching footsteps, the echoing click of hard shoes on concrete. I willed myself still, hoping they'd pass and there would be quiet again. But they stopped at their loudest, and the lock clicked and a door swung open, and three figures stood silhouetted by the light behind. Two enormous figures, and a smaller one in between.
"Mr. Kevin,"
a man said, and a dim bulb illuminated overhead. The two large men stepped forward and stood cross-armed on either side of me. They wore leather and mail, some kind of bizarre armor. Then the smaller man stepped into the light, a sharply featured man in an expensive suit. He glared at me with eyes like scalpels. At a glance, I knew he was evil, and I knew I was helpless to hide my fear.
"Mr. Kevin, first of all, I'd like to thank you for exposing a weakness in the security of our operation. If it weren't for Mr. Vandegrift's phone call, I believe we'd have had to select a different combatant for tomorrow's ceremony. This would have been an insult to the organization's traditions. All selectees must do battle on their designated date."
He paused. I don't know if he expected me to answer him, but I was unable to.
"I understand you have some affinity for Mr. Vandegrift. Some reason you'd rather not see him do battle in the arena tomorrow evening?"
"I know, Charlie," I said.
"I see. Familiarity breeds fondness, I've heard. Unfortunate."
We met eyes. I shivered. His gaze was reptilian. No humanity in those eyes to appeal to. Only some brutal operating system.
"Are you the Archon?"
I asked.
"Apt, young Kevin. So it's all up to me what to do with you."
"I promise I'll never tell anyone."
"Your friend Darien assured me you said that a month ago. Long before you told Mr. Vandegrift."
"I made a mistake."
He came closer.
"I understand you were in attendance at the last ceremony. Did you see all those people? Hundreds. And only one has managed to make such a mistake. A bad, bad mistake."
He stared me down with those eyes again.
"Luckily for you, Mr. Kevin, I have a code I operate by. I'm not a sentimental man, not an empathetic man, just a man with a code. And because you brought attention to a weak link in the security of my organization, my code demands I grant you some measure of leniency. Ordinarily, I'd use you for more experimental purposes. But for your exciting little fire drill, and the unusual fact that you are alone, we know you have no brother in Bethesda. Sans friends, sans family. The solitary type. You'll be recommended for a unique position.
Listen, about this whole Charlie thing.
Sentinels, stand him up.
With the sound of a motor, the platform I was secured to began to stand up. As I came face to face with the three men, I saw the true size of the masked sentinels. They must have been over 7 feet tall. The Archon, who appeared to be a shorter man at first, was at least as tall as me.
Since the dawn of biomechatronics, the elderly have proved our most convenient pool of subjects. Specifically, those who should not be missed. But with all the progress in the field, our most notable client is eager for younger, more durable specimens.
Durable? Me?
You should thank the gods I have some use for you. As for your careless friends, Mr. Darien and Mr. Samuel, I had no use for them anymore.
Please don't hurt me.
Hurt?
Said Archon Bloodbath.
It won't hurt, Mr. Kevin. Not yet.
They wheeled me out into the hall upright, but still strapped down.
Oh, Mr. Kevin.
I turned to look back at the Archon. He was holding out a gold coin.
I hope you don't mind, but I thought I'd take this back. As an employee, you'll no longer be needing it.
Where are you taking me?
I asked the sentinels, but they paid me no attention. We reached an elevator, got in, and to my shock, descended even deeper into the earth. We emerged into what looked like a laboratory setting. None of the wet dirt redolence of the upper levels, but bright, clean, and antiseptic. They rolled me through fluorescent hallways lined with labs, maybe medical labs. Was this where they treated battle-injured combatants? I stayed quiet. We came to a stop outside a set of double doors and went inside. Shortly, I had a lot of attention on me. People in masks and lab coats, doctors, I suppose, came over to examine me. The sentinels left without a word.
Where am I?
I asked as they unstrapped me, but they wouldn't acknowledge me either. They looked in my eyes with their scopes, in my ears, in my mouth. One felt my throat with his scaly hands. Another roughly performed a hernia test. In fact, cough was the only word said to me. After jotting some notes on a clipboard, the doctors vanished, and I was left sitting on a cot, alone with my thoughts. After a while, I tried not to think at all. Some time later, the door opened, and in stepped a man dressed in military attire carrying a briefcase. He said nothing at first, only watched me with hard blue eyes while he paced the room. It was like he wanted to see me from all angles. Eventually, his face softened and he spoke.
I'm General Bosch from the USBDP.
I'm Kevin.
Are you satisfied with your life?
I'm sorry?
He stopped.
I'm sorry what?
It took me a moment to understand what he was getting at.
Sir. I'm sorry, sir.
Are you satisfied with your life?
No. No, sir. Not particularly.
He began pacing again, left then right.
When you look back at your young life, son, would you say you're happy with your contribution to humanity? Are you proud of yourself?
No, sir.
He nodded.
Not many people are. Most of them you have to ask a few times, but they'll usually admit they aren't. They tell me they're proud of themselves the first time I ask, but when I ask them again, they admit it. It's because those dirtbags never bothered to consider it in the first place. You go to school?
I dropped out, sir, to deliver pizza. Now I deliver groceries.
So I've heard. You've been a regular profligate, but at least now you know it.
He seemed to size me up as he walked back and forth, to decide if I was worth anything. His eyes were as intense as the mirror shine of his boots.
You got a good back, kid?
Never had any problems, sir.
I'll bet we can get that puny body under 1,000 pounds of steel with the Rypan activatory activation implant.
Implant?
We'll let Merle have his fun with you first, of course. We owe the old poop some kind of finder's fee.
I'm confused, sir.
I believe you met Merle. But do yourself a favor and just call him Archon. Last combatant that called him Merle, well, let's just say he never made it to the arena.
He set down his briefcase and snapped open the latches and removed the folder and tossed it on the cot next to me. Property of the USBDP, it said.
Have a look,
he said, and threw me a pen. I caught it. He nodded.
That's for signing the papers. Just a formality, kid, not like you've got much choice in the matter. Just be a good soldier and accept your destiny.
He motioned that I open the folder, so I opened it and looked inside. There was no sense asking any more questions. The picture was vague, but the shape was clear.
Anyway, when you're done playing with Merle, we'll see if we can't make good with that life you wasted. Maybe do some good for your country.
He walked out of the room. I stared at the cover sheet. United States Biomechatronic Death Trooper Program.
5.
I'm not sure if it's true, but I've heard they now breed chickens without beaks. I suppose without a beak to peck with, they'd offer less resistance on the way to the nugget maker. I've heard they breed them without feathers, too. Although others have told me the feathers are filler for the nuggets. Feathers in the nuggets don't bother me. Again, it has an American Indian practicality to it. Disturbing is the idea that they can pluck the feathers right out of the DNA. Incidentally, Americans eat 8 billion chickens a year. That's a lot of chickens. I've tried to figure out how many nuggets that is, but if I were any good at math, I'd probably be doing something else for a living. And if I was doing something else for a living, I probably wouldn't be thinking about chickens and other unsavory bits of the food industry. I also never would have ended up in this situation. But there's no sense thinking that way. Like General Bosch said, be a good soldier and accept your destiny.
As the world spins small and silent under the apathetic stars, mankind waits fearfully in the imminence of death. But we, the organization, understand there can be no light without darkness, no life without death. So with death, we celebrate life for the organization. Tonight, midnight of the third Friday of the second month of the year, we have for you our champion, Agatha M. Higgins. Number 209, 78 years of age, and our challenger, Charles Vandegrift, number 284, 79 years of age. But hold your bets. Tonight, we have an extra special treat. I know we rarely stray from our traditions here, but times change. And so must the organization. So tonight, we meet a new breed of entertainer. From the always working, always improving labs of the USBDP, a new prototype tonight is put to the test. Allow me to introduce, at 35 years young, this grocery guru is specially equipped to deliver the goods. Previously weighing in at 165 pounds. Now a svelte 450 pounds in his class 11 DDP. Please welcome to Bloodbath Coliseum, Mr. Kevin!
The gate poles sunk into the sand. This was my cue. I stomped out into the bone-strewn desert of the arena floor. All I had to do was walk. Somehow, hundreds of pounds of steel followed suit. The crowd went wild, each of which consumed an average of 27 chickens per year. The armor covered everything but my head and midsection. My arms were clad to the shoulders in similar steel armor. Each finger of each oven door-sized glove tipped with a shining blade the length of a machete, all dragging in the sand behind me. I felt distinctly that the hardware was fastened directly into my bone structure. I suppose it hurt, but it was no bother. Pain was not what it used to be. I could feel it, but it was nothing more than a diagnostic tool to assess my condition. No fear. Whatever pulsed through my brain and body now prohibited this emotion. Also prohibited were the importances of right and wrong. I knew the difference. It's just that neither one seemed more important than the other. All that mattered was my job. My new job. To annihilate the competition. The trick of the implant was not lost on me. I was fully conscious of what it was doing to me. Amazing what it was doing to me.
And welcome the challenger and champion. 78 and 79 respectively. Traditionally outfitted in Class 10 Death Trooper Biomechatronics, Agatha Higgins and Charles Vandegrift.
The opposite gates went down, and out they came. Ms. Higgins and Charlie both had the same twin chainsaw getup that Agatha used a month ago. My vision was so sharp I could count the teeth on the blades. I could count the wrinkles on their faces. I could count them all at once. My hearing was so acute I could make out individual voices in the din of the crowd.
"This is gonna be a slob knocker, John," said Daniel Stern.
"You betcha, Dan," said John Hurd.
"Son?"
I met eyes with Charlie across the pit. He wore the same unconcerned look I knew I had on my face. The loudspeaker boomed with the voice of the Archon.
"For the first time in the history of the organization, it's a 2-on-1 matchup. As always, the prize of victory is to fight another day."
"Son?"
"Yeah, Charlie?"
"You were right,"
I chuckled. "Kinda goes without saying at this point, doesn't it?"
"Right about what?"
said Ms. Higgins.
"He told me about this whole thing. I thought he was crackers."
"He's a nice young man. He's not crackers."
"That's what I'm trying to tell him, Agatha."
"I understand, Charlie. It must have sounded crazy at the time. It is crazy."
"And you know what I was thinking earlier? Coliseum retirement home? How didn't I notice anything strange about that?"
"About what?"
said Ms. Higgins.
"The name."
He gestured around with a chainsaw.
"Look, it's a coliseum. Get it?"
"Oh, my."
"I just thought it was a name. Like the Rosenfeld Law Firm over by the A&P.
"You know Harriet from the fourth floor there? She used to do filing for Mr. Rosenfeld."
"Is that right? Anyway, son, sorry for not believing you."
"He's your son?"
No, Agatha, he's the delivery man.
I never had children.
That's all right, Charlie. I understand.
And thanks for the Salisbury steaks. You know, the thing about those Salisbury steaks is they're kind of soft. Like someone chewed them already for you.
You're welcome.
Do you have a girlfriend? I'll bet you have all sorts of girlfriends.
Not a one.
That's a shame. You should have a nice girlfriend. You're not. You know.
He's not a Mary, Agatha. You're not, are you?
No. I guess I just never really met anyone.
The food here is wonderful, Charlie. Have you tried the pot roast?
They gave me a turkey dinner, but they had to put the turkey in the food processor machine. I'm still waiting for my pills. They never got them from my room.
The pot roast is fabulous. It just falls right apart.
The crowd was in a steady uproar. I zeroed in on George Bush and Bill Clinton. George was showing Bill his new earring. He had just got it pierced. It hadn't hurt at all, he told him. Bill said he'd get one too, but only if George went with him. George agreed.
Those boys have fresh mouths,
Ms. Higgins said.
Forget the pills,
Charlie said.
What do I need them for? I'll be dead soon.
Oh, stop it. And that was The Organization by Jeff Sturdivant. A little about the author. So Jeff is the guy who does the drudgery on this show while I bask in all the glory. Other than that, he writes stories, narrates audiobooks, drives a big brown truck, and masturbates. Not at the same time, I don't think. I don't know. I don't care. Don't want to know. But if he does and drives that big brown truck at the same time, they're going to have to get some doors for those damn things. Anyway, this story is from his award-winning audiobook, Occupational Hazards, available on audible.com, which he would love you to spend the credit on. And if you click on his name in the narrator field, he's currently got 52 audiobooks he'd love you to check out too. And feel free to follow Jeff on Facebook. He's inappropriately friendly and will immediately overstep his societally imposed boundaries. And Jeff, if you ever write something that hard for me to say again, I'll have you crippled.
And do old Drew Blood a favor, would you? Subscribe to his podcast wherever you do your listening and leave him a 5-star review and a kind word, even if you're listening on YouTube. He needs soldiers on all fronts to win this battle, and he appreciates it. To hear a premium ad-free edition of tonight's and all the other episodes, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click Patrons in the upper menu. You'll find yourself at ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com, where you can become a patron for as little as $5 per month and get access to their entire audio archive, all ad-free and available to download or stream. Thank you for your time and for supporting our sponsors. When you support our sponsors, you support this show. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all the latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with them each and every week. Oh, and you can find Drew Blood on Facebook and Instagram, and sometimes Twitter. The Drew Blood's Dark Tales podcast is accepting submissions, friend. If you've got a story or two you'd like to be featured on the show, send it to drewbloodhorror@gmail.com. If selected, you'll get the full treatment, 10 bananas.
I'm afraid this is where we part ways, at least till next week. So hit the bricks, will you? I think that was enough time for the stakes to rest. You can hang around for Chester's Bottle Rockets if you want to, but don't expect the grand finale. In any case, may the wind be at your back, and may the road rise up to meet you. I'll see you all next week, and as always, go fuck yourselves.
Not y'all.